Good evening. We've come to the last lesson in this series on parenting. I want to thank you for the opportunity to have come up here and discussed this with you from the scriptures. I want to thank you for your interest in it. I want to compliment you on your interest in it. It's, as I said this morning, it's wonderful to see a congregation with children in it, with young children in it. It brings a vibrancy, and it's a hope for future strength for the work. But that will depend on what we do to a large extent in the rearing and the raising of our children. They will have to make their choice to stand before God, but we will have made the likelihood of that choice much more when we are doing what we should do in the training of them. We had finished up with fathers discouraging and provoking to wrath. If you weren't here this morning, what we're talking about today is some common pitfalls that we can fall into as parents. Failing to discipline was number one. Rewarding misbehavior was number two. Expecting misbehavior was number three. Failing to be consistent, that's a really big one, number four. Thinking I don't have time was number five. Failing to control self was number six. Failing to use both rod and reproof together in a constructive way was number seven. And then we finished on fathers discouraging and provoking to wrath, which Paul talked about two times in the epistles. Now we come to the ninth lesson that we're going to discuss, and that is settling for situation control instead of training the child. This one is really important and really valuable. And it's the difference between good parenting and better parenting. There are some people who do a pretty good job of parenting who try to control their children. But the Bible didn't tell us in Proverbs 22:6, control your children, and when they are old, they will go in the right way. It said what? Train your children. That's a different thing. Sometimes we, and I'm going to mention a couple of things here that I don't think are good parenting, because they're kind of down below that. You've heard of fathers who say things like this: no child of mine is going to do that under my roof. Well, good. But you see what's missing there? You know, what's the extent of his, I'm taking a stand, my children are not going to do that under my roof. So where are they going to do it? Not under my roof, or as soon as they get out from underneath my roof. It's a failure to train. That's not good enough. Here's a comment. Well, we'll get to that one in a few minutes. Let me go on to this. This point was made in Michael and Debbie Pearl. I don't know if any of you know who they are. They're kind of a Calvinistic, evangelical, fundamentalist couple down somewhere in Tennessee, but they write some good books that have to do with child training. And it's very anecdotal, some of their books are. They'll have a little chapter, and here's an incident with a particular child, and then there's the lesson from it. And I want to share one of their illustrations. It's from their book, To Train Up a Child. And it's, I think their chapter is called Twinkie Twerp. I've got Twinkie Brat up there. But it may not, I might not have it perfectly, but it goes basically like this. There's a mom who is a real incident. Her boy is there, and another mother or two maybe has brought some other kids over. And so there's several children, and her son comes from the backyard into the house, and there's one Twinkie left in the house. Boy, he gets a Twinkie. He starts heading outside. Okay, every mom realizes the problem here, right? You don't have a proper ratio between Twinkies and children. You've got one Twinkie and a bunch of kids. So she says what to the child? No, 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 you can't do that. There's not enough Twinkies for everybody. At that point, the child decides he wants a Twinkie. And he makes like he's going to tear open the Twinkie and eat it. The mom realizes, oh no, he didn't obey. He's going for the Twinkie. So she decided her job was to get the Twinkie. That's what she thought her job was. She goes for the Twinkie. He doesn't want her to have the Twinkie. She grabs that. He pulls at it. And there's a little wrestling match that goes on between Mom and Junior over the Twinkie. You can imagine what the Twinkie might have looked like after this was done. After the battle is over, Mom is older, Mom is bigger. She got the Twinkie. And the little guy says, "Thinking I have a graham cracker?" And she goes, "Okay. What did she do wrong?" She decided she needed to control the situation. Did she? Well, if the situation, if what she thought was important here was not to let one Twinkie go out amongst a bunch of children, what did she need to be taken care of? The defiant rebellion from her child. And she made the mistake of settling for situation control instead of training the child. I'm going to give you an incident now, and Brianne knows this is coming because I always do this. Because other my kids have done it as well, but the particular time she does it, this illustrates it very well. And this may be, for some of you, this may be one of the more important, valuable things you'll hear. When I did this in Maryland, and I do this series in various places. I'll be in Nebraska next month and then Pennsylvania. But when I was doing this in Maryland, one of the moms there came up 2 or 3 days later, and she said this next point. She said, "This was a life-altering experience, you know, getting this point." Because she said, "My daughter, just after 3 days, she is behaving, and she is happy." Let me illustrate what this is. Brianne is, at this point, I think, 2. I'm not sure. She might have been 3. I think she was 2. And we're getting in the car to go. She's old enough that she can get in her own little, you know, booster car seat. That was her job, to get in the car, buckle herself in. Well, she gets in, and that's what she's supposed to do, except this time she doesn't. I start up the car, and I'm starting back, and my older daughter, April, says, "Dad, Brianne didn't get in her car seat." I said, "Get in your car seat," and she doesn't. Well, what do I need to do? I don't need to tell her, "Don't make me tell you again. You know, I'm going to count 3. You know, listen, I don't do all that." I realize, well, she needs to be punished. She disobeyed. Now, you have to understand, Brianne was probably the easiest of all of us. Adam gave us some trouble, Zach gave us some trouble, currently Luke has given us some trouble. And sometimes the girls would give us some trouble, April, Brianne, and Tabitha. But Brianne was one of those, and you had different children, you know, the ones where you just kind of look at them, and they're, "Oh, let me go back." Well, that was usually Brianne. But you also know how children, even good children, are going to do what sometimes? Every once in a while, they're going to go for it, you know, and this was the day she's going for it. I don't realize that this is go for it day. She does. So I pull over. This is very unlike Brianne to just divide an instruction. So I pull the car over and stop by the creek, and I say, "Brianne," and I get her out, and I walk over, and I get a switch, and I usually don't use a switch. This was pretty serious, and just would not obey. So, we sit there, and we have the lecture. Remember, we talked about Rod and her group. We have the lecture. Go through the lecture. Explain my job before God. Explain what she's done, et cetera. And then say, "Okay, and now she gets her spank. All right. Now, Brianne, get back in the car seat." And Brianne gets up, and she sat beside the car seat. I bring her back down. We have the lecture again. Going to be a harder spanking this time. We go through the lecture. We go through the spanking. Now, Brianne, get in your car seat. This time, Brianne got out and she sat down beside the car seat. I brought Brianne in. Again. Again we went through the lecture. Again we went through the spanking. Now, Brianne, this time, get in your car seat. This time, she got up and she sat down beside her car seat. I took her out again. We had the lecture again. Spanked her again. And I think it was on the 5th time she finally sat down in her car seat. Now, here's what's important there. We all know what could have saved a lot of time and trouble. Well, I could have put her in the car seat. I'm bigger than her. I could have put her in the car seat. Would that have trained her? What had she done? She had disobeyed. What does she need to do? Obey. You see the difference in that? And that, getting that point, that's what this mom in Maryland said. She said, that's what I would do. You know, when I tell her, get in the high chair, get out, and she wouldn't, you know, I would just forcefully put her in the high chair, or forcefully take her out. And so she was just having these battles and stuff. And she said, after thinking about that, She said, this is like 2 or 3 days later, she's just been life-altering. She said, for the past 2 or 3 days, I have nipped every defiance in the bud. And she's behaving, and she's happy. Train up the children. Train up the children. Mere control versus training, when they get out on their own, they're out of our what? Control. And if they haven't learned self-control, they're going to do what they want to do. I heard just recently about a fellow who, I know both of them, knew both of them when they were growing up. And she would get a little mouthy sometimes. He didn't get mouthy, but he was just biding his time. Just recently she told me, my brother said, his philosophy to her was just, you just lay low, follow the rules, and after a while you're out, and then you can do what you want. And that's what he did. Training involves more than just control. Proverbs said, and that shouldn't be 13:24, that should be 22:6. Sorry about that typo. Train up a child in the way he should go. And even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Why? Because you trained the child. Little boy, I mentioned this in the class yesterday, and I don't know where it was. I wasn't there. I don't know if it was at school or at home or at Bible class or what. But a little boy was standing up, and the teacher or whoever it was had said they had to sit down. And there was a little bit of a... And finally they got the child to sit down, and he sat down. But as he did, he said, all right, but I'm still standing up on the inside. Well, guess what? When mine does that, when yours does that, guess what? We're not done. Because our job, believe it or not, the most important thing going on there is not whether or not they sit down. Right? The important thing is that they be trained. Because in another situation, maybe they didn't need to sit down. But when you require them to sit down, now they need to sit down. They need to learn that to respect authority from you, and that will help them respect authority from other people in positions of authority. Teachers, Bible class teachers, various such things, police, laws, and ultimately and most importantly, God. Train their hearts. Number 10, the mistake of thinking if we don't allow this, they might rebel and leave the church. Sometimes parents think, I'm not sure that's a good idea, but we better allow it because they might rebel. Then they want to do this. We better allow it, but we don't want them to leave the church. How many of you would burn down your house to keep it from catching fire? That would keep it from catching fire, right? I just worried that my house might burn down. It could. Yeah, I just worried about it a lot. Yeah, I don't have to worry anymore. Well, I burned it down. Don't give your children over to the world because you're afraid that they might go to the world. And you say, well, but I don't want them to leave the church. What good is being in the church if they aren't in the Lord? The church at Laodicea in Revelation chapter 3. They had a bunch of people that were in that church, and they were all where? They were outside of the Lord. God said, the Lord said, I wish you were cold or hot, but because you're lukewarm, I'll spew you out of my mouth. He said, I'm at the door knocking. He was no longer there with them. Doesn't do us any good to just be in a group of people or be on a church directory if we're not serving the Lord. James 4, verse 4. Do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Entertainment, attire, interests. Some of the things that you see children wear. I think I mentioned to the class yesterday, a friend of mine, he went to buy some clothes for his daughters. And he went in the shop, and you know what it's like, right? I mean, it's disgusting, some of the little trampy outfits. In fact, some recently came out with pimp wear for infants, a couple of years ago. But just the trashy stuff. And he goes in the store at the mall, and he looks around, and he went over to the clerk, and he said, "Excuse me." He said, "Do you have anything other than prostitute clothing?" And I thought it was a point well made. Because that's what a lot of those places are selling. You see mothers and fathers at ball games, walking through the mall and stuff, and you wonder what on earth they are thinking, letting their children dress like that. And if our kids are being swayed by the world, influenced by the world, their friends and various such things, they say, "Oh, I'm over there, so I want to," and we think, "Oh, I better let them do that. I better let them do that." It's not a good thing to do. Don't let them do it. You're not supposed to train your children to be molded to the world. You're supposed to be training your children to be molded to the ways of God. It doesn't take much training to get a child to be molded to the ways of the world. It's kind of like gravity, pouring out water. It's going to conform to the lowest level. Interests, attire, and things. And sometimes, let me say a word about entertainment. I mentioned video games this morning. Video games are not wrong in and of themselves. And you may have a game that you particularly like. They are pretty addictive. It can be. But, if a person has a game they like, that can be okay. But I think it gets to be a real problem. And it's a little bit sad, too, how much kids get involved in it. Twice this summer, I had occasion to drive a van full of teenagers. And you know what? I think when a bunch of guys are together in a van on a trip, that would be a really good time for them to interrelate and joke and talk to each other. But sometimes, if you get a van full of teenagers, you know where they are? This is on an iPod, this is on an MP3, and they're all just, they've got their little electronic things going on. And now, family vans now, you know what they come with, a lot of them? DVD for this seat, DVD for this seat, DVD for this seat, DVD for this seat. And so here, you remember Deuteronomy 6, when did it say to teach your children? When you rise up, when you lay down, when you walk in the way. Well, when you're driving, that's a good time for family to interact, either to talk about spiritual things, or to just enjoy one another's company and joke around or sing a song or discuss things. That's a good interactive time, kind of like at the table. But if everybody's there, and we're becoming a nation of people to an extent that's not connected. Kids that, here's how they play basketball. Here's how they play baseball. Here's football. They want to go out on an adventure. It's not climb a mountain. It's climb a mountain. I'm not saying those things are wrong, but as parents, in church, we don't make rules for other people that aren't rules of God. Fathers, mothers, you have the right to make rules in your house. When you see something that's not in or absolutely wrong, have the wisdom, though, to see where that's going. You know why we lose a lot of young people? A lot of churches lose half their young people, some more. One of the reasons why? Because parents are not being, Romans 12, don't be fashioned according to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It's not firm enough in the parents' minds. And it's not firm enough in their wisdom of thinking what they want their kids to be involved in. And so they go, "Well, it's not sinful. Yeah, you can do that. Yeah, you can do that." There's some things that just, they don't head down a really good road. Let me give you an example. Suppose your one of your kids likes a particular song.
Okay.
Likes a particular album.
Okay.
They want that CD.
Okay.
It's not vulgar. It's not full of profanity. Fine. But you know what? If they start getting obsessed, and they're all about this band and that band, and you start noticing that they're hanging out with everybody, and they're all wearing black, and there's a skull here and some bones, and up go the posters, and everything, you know, they don't seem to be very interested in the Apostle Paul. They're not very interested in Abraham. They're not, oh, they're so interested in this. You know what? What's a wise parent going to realize before it gets to that point? I don't think so. There's an obsession here about something that's connected, oftentimes, to a lot of worthless things in culture and drug use and a lot of other things. No! Catch that stuff before it takes them over. Don't think that, and don't say no to everything. Let your kids do some things. Let your kids have fun. But if you see something that's heading in the wrong direction, don't encourage that. Bring the child back to be focused on something better. Start training early. Number 11, thinking what they really need is more and more money. Is life expensive now? Yeah. Is real estate expensive? Yeah. Is gas expensive? Yeah. Is insurance expensive? Yeah. But with that said, we as Americans have confused, in many, many cases, luxury with necessity. We don't have to have everything we have. We got far more than we need. We've got luxury upon luxury upon luxury that our grandparents and great-grandparents didn't have. A lot of good people came out of problems. Now, let me put it this way. How many of you, and I'd like to see a show of hands, how many of you have in your life, whether a media family or extended family or friends, known people that have been deeply scarred emotionally and psychologically and spiritually and such because of being raised in a dysfunctional home? Emotional abuse in the home, various problem abuse in the home, that the home, the ungodly atmosphere of the home. How many of you have known people that have been scarred deeply because of being raised in a dysfunctional home? Raise your hand if you know people like that. Okay, keep those hands up for a second. How many of you know people, you can put them down, how many of you know people that are civilly scarred because they were brought up in not as nice a house? Go ahead, raise your hand. I don't see any. But you don't know people that are scarred because, oh, other people lived in this kind of house, and we lived in a house with shag carpet or sculpted carpet, and the avocado green washer and the white dryer and the bathroom window had a piece of duct tape over a broken pipe, and that's why I can't get a job today. That's why I can't emotionally interconnect with my wife. You ever met people like that? Because why? You know, if you can have a non-broken window, great. That's wonderful. If you can have a vacuum laundry dryer, more power to you. My point is simply this. We've got a nation full of people that are putting a lot of emphasis on the house and almost no emphasis on the home. And that's upside down. Back to that. Well, we need money, but what the family needs more is a good home. If you have a good home and a beautiful house, wonderful. Job. Do you imagine Job had a nice house compared to his neighbors? I imagine he did. Was his heart first on God? Yes, it was. Nothing wrong with having both, but if there's got to be some give, if you can't have them both, which one needs to go? Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and turmoil with it. Better is a dish of vegetables where love is than a fattened ox served with hatred. You know, one time I caught a kid for shoplifting, and I saw the house he lived in. Beautiful house. He lived there with his father and his stepmother, and his father didn't like him at all. It doesn't sound like him. Probably his stepmother even less. He was just empty and vacant inside. Here he's stealing stuff. Beautiful house. Wretched home. Better is little with fear of the Lord than great treasure and turmoil with it. Better is a dish of vegetables where love is, and in fact, not with served with hatred. And you've heard this before. Have you ever seen a headstone? Fellas, think about that overtime and stuff. Overtime pays good money, doesn't it? You ever seen a headstone walking through the graveyard and it said, "I wish I'd spent more time at the office"? Anybody ever seen that? Has that ever been the dying words of somebody? "Wish I'd worked more overtime." I don't think so. At what price would you sell the opportunity to train and raise your children? You think about that. If we lose our children, you know, we buy insurance policies for all sorts of things. I pay one company money to take care of it in case my house burns down. I pay another company money, maybe it's the same one, in case my car, you know, gets stolen. I pay insurance for my health. I pay insurance for this. How much would you pay if, after losing one of your children to the world, to drugs or various such things, if somebody could come and sell you a time machine and you could go back before the problem started and spend the time with that child and get off that problem? Would you differ on the premium? Would you sit there and they said, "It's going to cost you this much"? Would you go, "Oh, you know, I'm planning on buying the boat this year. I don't think I can fit that in the budget"? Would you worry about how much it costs? Or would you put down the money to go back in time to be able to fix it? Well, here's what many parents are doing. They're selling the time now that they have and missing an opportunity. We need to think about how much time we spend with our families. Note mom's primary place. Now remember in Proverbs 31, the worthy woman, she made money. She considered a field and she bought it. She worked with her hands, she made garments, and she left the home. She goes into town, trades with merchants, and sells them. It's not wrong for a woman to make money. But if career comes ahead of taking children, is that a problem? If the primary occupation is money, and what ends up being, you know, limited time is taking care of kids, is the important thing getting the important time, or is the less important thing getting the important time? Titus chapter 2, read that with me please, verse 5. By the way, this is a side point. How do we usually use the word doctrine? Usually, here's moral issues and here's doctrinal issues. That's not the way the Bible really uses the words. Doctrine just means teaching. Sometimes we think, "Hey, you hold the sound doctrine?" We're about to read what Paul calls sound doctrine. Listen to this. Sound doctrine. And that's the way the American Standard translates it. Titus 2, verse 1. Titus is told, "Speak thou the things that befit the sound doctrine, that aged men be temperate, grave, sober-minded, sound in faith and love and patience, that aged women likewise be reverent in demeanor, not slanderers, nor enslaved to much wine, teachers of that which is good." One. Verse 4. "That they," the older women, "may train the young women to do what? to love their husbands, love their children, be sober-minded, chaste, workers at home, kind, being in subjection to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. Workers at home, to love their husbands, love their children. Every once in a while, and I mentioned this yesterday, so I'll just mention it ever so briefly today. Every once in a while, you'll meet somebody who has friends that they say they're going to leave their husband or leave their wife. You say, why? I don't love them. And they view love as something you either have or you don't. What does the Bible say? Older women are to train younger women to do what? To love their husband. And as we talked about yesterday, too often we in our society think of love as what we get. Ooh, I love her because here's what I get. John 3:16, God so loved the world that he, yay. Love involves giving. And women, the younger women are to be trained to love their husbands, love their children, to be workers at home and such. And then, as we have up here also, Proverbs 31 doesn't mean that she can't make money or do some other work, but when you read the worthy woman, where is she dedicated? You can see she's centered and dedicated on the home. What's more important, the quality of the house or the quality of the home? Number 12, we got two left here. Number 12, mistaking taking them to church for bringing them up in the nature, nurture and admonition of the Lord. I was down in Alabama, and we went and picked up a brother from the hospital, older brother. And he was bemoaning the fact that none of his children were faithful to God. I think he had 4 children. They were about my age. And they were all unfaithful to God. And he said something really sad. Here's what he said. No, that's not what he said. Well, let me go back. I thought I had on there what he said. I'll tell you what he said. I don't know what happened. We took them to church all those years. I don't know what happened. But if I see what happened. Church, if you go Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night, does that even compete with how many commercials a kid sees in a week, typically? Think how much exposure he has to the world, to things at this friend's house, here, there, and all the crud that's available on TV if they're exposed to that and such. Think of all that, and then, oh, here, we took them to church. Oh, that should be. And then they migrate to the back pew, and they sit back there like this, looking bored and stiff, and then they go off to college, and they don't go to church anymore. And I don't know what happened. Did God say that the church is to bring up the children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? Who did he give that job to? Fathers. Ephesians chapter 6. Verse 4. Ye fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath, but instead do what? Fathers are told to do this. Nurture them in the chastening and admonition of the Lord. Sometimes we fathers can think that most of the stuff is mom's job. Fathers are told. Your job is to raise them, nurture them, and bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Back in Deuteronomy 6, who is told to train the children? Teach them. You shall teach them diligently to your sons. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you raise up. And bring them to church. And let them take advantage of good Bible classes and such that are available there. But don't think that's their training. Where's the training need to be done? At home. Where do they need to be taught? At home. Where do they need to be nurtured and all that and brought up in the nurture and admonition? At home. And so parents, take the time, teach them to do right, train them to do right, and expect them to do right. the last one, and there's an associated point with this as well, it's lowering the bar from the firstborn to the baby. This happens a lot. This is a stereotypical thing. Not every family does it. And not every firstborn is like some firstborns. Not every lastborn is like some other borns. But it happens a lot. And here's what it is. The firstborn, well, just stop and think about it. In your own family, or in your extended family, or your uncles, or whatever, the firstborn and the baby, which one is more likely to hold a job, be successful, financially independent, you know, and mature quickly and stuff? Not always, but often it's the firstborn. And if there's somebody that always has trouble holding a job and stuff, oftentimes it's lateral. Now, I'm not a firstborn. Don't do that. What am I to be honest? I'm not trying to, you know, I was born later, not they. My brother matured a lot faster than me. And when I came along, just to give you an example, let's see, Jeff was a year and 9 months older than me. He was valedictorian. I was not. The teachers selected him to go to Boise State. They did not select me. He was freshman class president in college. I was not. I think at some point I got voted least likely to succeed. Not most likely to succeed, least likely to succeed. I remember at one point I had a teacher. She had just had Jeff the year before, and she'd given a homework assignment, and I hadn't done it. And I came in and I said, Ms. Frickley, I'm sorry I didn't do that homework assignment. It was the beginning of the year. She thought I was Jeff. She said, oh, Scott Smeltzer, you know you did. No, I didn't. And she found out I didn't. Jeff was doing a lot of things better than I was. And I wasn't trying sometimes to do what he was doing. Now, not everybody's like that and such, but there are some typical things here. And let me illustrate. Luke chapter 15, when Jesus tells the story of the prodigal son, do you notice there's an interesting little detail in there? He didn't just say one of the sons went off and squandered all the money. Which son went off and squandered all the money? It was the younger son, wasn't it? Why? Let me give you a couple of reasons. One, you can see it from a pacifier. It's your first baby, right? Baby number one. You bring it home from the hospital. You've been reading books on baby care. You got all the stuff. Here's the baby powder. There's the baby wipes. There's the diapers. Everything's all ready and such. And you sit there, and the pacifier falls on the ground. Oh, what do you do? You pick that thing up, and you sterilize it, you know, get under hot water, make sure you get all the crevices and everything at home. You don't want anything to happen to that precious little baby. But baby number two, yeah, cold water a little bit. Baby number three. Baby number four, let the dog lick it. You know? Baby number five, just why? For one reason, we've realized that in some ways we were a little overprotective. With that first baby, we thought, oh, something could go wrong. And so we do everything so carefully. And then the baby comes out well. And then we think, you know, I don't think I needed to do all that stuff. And partly that's right. You don't have to sterilize the pacifier every time you find that out. And you know, before when it took me 5 minutes to change the diaper and all the little processes, you know, by the bed you're like, you know, like that. You realize some of that stuff wasn't necessary, but you see what happens in the mind and you get overconfident. And the first one came along well, and we think, oh, that wasn't so hard after all. So what do we do on the next one? We don't take it quite as seriously. And along with slacking off on the pacifier, what do we start doing? We start slacking off on the discipline. Start slacking off on the expectation. And that does cause a difference. That's one of the things. Here's another. Baby number one, born into the family, which is peer group. Adults. In the home, there's nobody but adults. So who does he relate to? Adults. The baby, by the time the baby's born, who's in the family? There's kids. Who's he related to? And models behavior after? Kids. If one baby models their behavior after adults and another models their behavior after kids, is it a surprise one's going to be more mature quicker than the other? It's partly just the nature of how it's going to work. The last born is going to relate more to children. And here's another one. Baby number one. You remember when you had baby number one? You remember waiting to see the first smile? Remember that? I think she smiled. No, that's Gavin. No, I think it was a smile. No. Ooh, you're doing everything you can to get that smile. You remember the baby book? You know, and you wrote down the day it first smiled. The day it first took a step. The day... This is kind of sad. Lucas doesn't have a baby book. He doesn't have a baby book. Sorry. But at some point, you started that stuff. But and we don't have the rest of it. But by the last phase, is everybody so eager for it to grow up quick? Sometimes by the last baby we want to walk. In fact, believe and say sometimes, you hear mom say, oh, I don't want him to grow up too fast. I want to enjoy that stuff. And subconsciously, instead of challenging them to mature, we slow them down. And so how many times have you heard grown women, I mean grown women, talking about their grown son that may be 42 years old, and she said, oh, but that's my baby. You ever heard that? Apron strings tight. Sometimes mom doesn't want that last one to grow up. And guess what? Sometimes he doesn't. So, what do we need to remember? You probably don't have to sterilize fast or fire each time. But do give the training and the teaching to each child, because each of them needs it. And because of some other things like this, some of them may mature a little bit faster than others. That's okay. But challenge and train them, and don't enable them. Don't support immaturity. Don't, heard about one case where grown child that, you know, could hardly hold a job, marriage, couldn't hold the marriage, just living in, I think, parents' basement, and one of the person in the family pointed out to parents, well, it's because of things you do for them. They said, like what? Like the car you bought him. He said, I didn't buy him that car, you know, he's paid for that car, if he ever pays me back. Don't enable. When did the prodigal son come to himself? If you look at the text there, the verse that says he came to himself and repented, you know what it says right before he came to himself? And no one gave to him. If his father says, oh, poor Junior, here's some money, you think he would have come to himself?
I want to say just a couple words connected with this birth order thing and say this quickly about temperament. And then the lesson will be yours. Sorry for going a little long this evening.
If you have more than one child, you've probably noticed that they don't come into the same world with the same personality, right? Sometimes the firstborn will be a pleaser, and because of other reasons we talked about, he does real well, and he gets parents overconfident, and then they get blindsided by a strong-willed second child or third child. What I want to suggest to you is that there are advantages and disadvantages to each of these. Which is easier? The pleaser? You know, the child, it's not, yeah, they will misbehave sometimes. Yes, they will challenge you sometimes, but in generally, they want what? They want mommy's approval. They want daddy's approval. You know, they hug, they smile. They want to be with mom, they want to be with dad. And then there's that strong-willed child, you know, he wants to do his stuff. And if you don't like it, he doesn't really care. You know, he just grows strong-willed. Which child is easier? The pleaser. And we might think, oh, this would be wonderful. Do I have to worry about that child? Yes, you do. The child that wants everybody to approve of them and please people around them what are they going to do when they get in high school and all their friends want them to do this or do that? Don't please. April was a pleaser. April was a wonderful girl. But when we lived in Rhode Island, I was really surprised one day. She was just a real good girl. And one day we had another family over that had a little boy. It was not a very good boy. And I walked into the room, and this boy has come to my house, and he's got a marker or a pen, and he's just writing all over the wall. And guess who's beside him doing the same thing? April! She's a girl, girl. Why is she doing that? Somebody else wanted to do that, and she went along with what they wanted to do. If you got a pleaser, you may need to teach them back home. And strong-willed, you know what strong-willed and stubborn is the flip side of? Backbone. Now, they need to be trained not to be stubborn about getting their own way. They need to be trained not to be stubborn about everything's for me. They need to become, you know, have backbone to stand up for what's right and serve God. Probably some of the heroes and leaders in history, I'm going to guess, were strong-willed kids. Some of the people that are best at facilitating and getting along with people are sometimes pleasers. There's challenges both ways. I don't know, have no way of knowing for sure, but if I was going to guess, if you knew Paul when he was a little boy and Barnabas when he was a little boy, which would you guess was more likely strong-willed? Which would you guess was more likely a pleaser? Remember, Barnabas is doing great. Peter comes along, sets a real bad example. What does Barnabas do? Right along with it. Does Paul seem to have trouble confronting problems and standing against things? No, he stands right up in front of everybody and calls Peter down for his sin right on the spot. Strong will can be a good thing if it's brought into control of God. Being a pleaser and wanting to get along with people can be a good thing. And the strong-willed person may need to learn and does need to learn to be considerate of other people and stuff. And the pleaser needs to learn that sometimes you have to do what doesn't please people and stand up. And it's not going to be as easy for them, but they need to learn how to do it.
And win and your child wins. Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way that he should go, even when he is old. He will not depart from it. Like other things in Proverbs, they're not absolute. Sometimes you get a soft answer and it doesn't turn away wrath. But it generally works, and this generally works too. And the more we focus on giving our children training up in the Lord, the more joy they bring to us, the more peace to our home, the more growth to God's kingdom, and the more godly offspring they offer. Thank you for your attention. If anyone's up to that, you want to come and say with us.